Chapter 1. Another time, another place. The lights in the screening room go down and we find ourselves in cozy, womb-like darkness. A switch is clicked behind us and a projector splutters into life. Uneven at first, its jerky start soon settles into a solid purr as the images start to flicker up on the screen at 24 frames per second. They're not very bright as the black background platforms the skinny white countdown numbers 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3. And then we're there. Moving pictures, transporting the Ellis room into a portal on the world and all its past, present and future glories. And within seconds we are transported as well. Although we're not quite as gauche as the Parisian audiences of the 1890s, who screamed and dived for cover as film of a moving train rolled toward them, we too are soon believing what we see. Decking for cover as the hero ducks, twitching during the fights, tapping our feet to the music and feeling the anger, pain and joy just as he does. Liverpool, England, the 9th of October 1940. The port city is not as uncluttered as much of it is in the 21st century. The Luftwaffe and the post-war planners have yet to wreak their full havoc, though the seafront area and many of the older buildings still have the wide-ranging space and self-confidence of the Victorian era that made them. Many of these buildings were funded by the profits from African slavery and from the lesser, but endless, exploitation of local workers. Neither subject is considered fit to be discussed in school in the 1940s or in the newspapers, nor will they be for decades to come. It is a very different world from today's. Trams rumble through streets where a few men still wear wooden clogs. Only a few, though. This isn't Wigan Pier in the hungry 30s. Most of the men smoke cheap cigarettes at work in the docks, or in factories, cafes and offices. Virtually everyone wears a hat outside, and even most of the kids wear school caps out of school, the boys stuck in short trousers until they leave school, the majority bowing out of education at the ripe old age of 14. Most of these kids, like their parents, will never have used a telephone or a refrigerator. It will take the miracles of modern warfare, mass production and a social sea change to introduce these other wonders into the homes of the majority. In the cold autumn, the majority of homes that have coal or firewood are belching out smoke, combined with the acrid smell of burnt brickwork and melting bakelite that still hangs in the air, courtesy of a bombing raid several days before. It gives Liverpool the aura of Guy Fawkes' Night Come Early. Britain and France have been at war with Nazi Germany for over a year. France has already fallen under German occupation, as of Poland, Holland, Belgium, Luxembourg and Holland. In the Oxford Street Maternity Hospital, 26-year-old Julia Lennon, a cinema usherette, gives birth to John Winston Lennon. The newly born's first name, John, had been suggested by Julia's older sister Mimi Smith. This pair have three other sisters, so the arrival of a boy will lead to much celebration. The boy's middle name comes from Winston Churchill, Britain's inspirational wartime prime minister since May that year, when Labour MPs forced him on a reluctant Tory-dominated government. By December 1940, it is a national government. The child's father, Alfred Freddie Lennon, is away at sea at the time of the birth, fulfilling his role as a head waiter in the Merchant Navy. One safe job that now, with British vessels being torpedoed every week, is no longer quite so cushy. Mimi, however, visits daily. On the 10th, she even ducks and scurries her way through a bombing raid to visit Julia and her child. Her interest, and the future pattern of the extended family, is already set before the child has left the maternity hospital. Freddie's roots lay in Ireland. Liverpool was then regarded, only half-jokingly, as being the capital of Ireland, and he was later to claim that his own father was a member of Ireland's famous Kentucky Minstrels, an assertion dismissed by other members of the family. He is usually described as forthright, a euphemism for awkwardness, for being bolshy, something which could only make his marriage to the musically talented flighty Julia Stanley a bit of a roller coaster. As part of her job, she had already spent thousands of hours in cinemas, nightly absorbing vast silver screen dreams that few men, least of all Freddie Lennon, could ever have made true. Within 3 years of their registry office wedding, the relationship, damaged by a wall that extended Fred's absences, was already dying. Although he sent money, at first, to help his newborn son, Fred has hardly seen the child and doesn't have a prolonged conversation with him until the latter is almost 6 years old. Once the payments stop, Julia abandons all pretense of being happily married and starts to see other men. She'd already left little John Lennon with his Aunt Mimi within 6 months of his birth. Mimi and her husband George Smith will be his effective parents for most of the next 15 years,